When Bruce Schuetz called me yesterday morning and told me we'd have to postpone the musical program he had intended for today because he had the flu and wasn't up to it, I began to think about what I'd have to speak to you this morning. I decided to talk to you about the founder of Hasidism, Israel Baal Shem Tov. Those modern-day disciples are among the most fundamentalist of the Black Hat Orthodox and a troublesome group within Israel. The Baal Shem Tov had an original mind and is created with many valuable insights and understandings. Israel, the Baal Shem Tov, the master of a good name, the founder of Hasidism, the movement of a religious revival, ecstasy, and enthusiasm, which warmed the lives of many of our fathers in Eastern Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries, throughout his life, refused to write down his teachings. He felt that wisdom and counsel had meaning only in a particular context. The philosophy of wisdom set in cold type lost not only specificity, but immediacy. Reduced wisdom to type in its blood of life. When we look back on those men and women whose spiritual personalities have most deeply impressed mankind, it's interesting that so many shared the Baal Shem's conviction and refused to set down their teachings. Gautama, Zoroaster, the founder of Persian dualism, and Jesus are cases in point. Men have refused to set down their knowledge and wisdom lest it be distorted. So of all these men, we have only legends about their actions and their teachings. I recently reread a little book called Shivchei HaBesht, The Praise of the Baal Shem Tov. It was compiled in the year 1814, 54 years after the Baal Shem's death. It consists of legends, folklore, and bits of biography which have been passed down from city to city and from generation to generation among the disciples of their master. I found among these stories this little vignette. A demon carrying a bookcase, carrying a book under his arm, approached the Baal Shem. The Baal Shem was surprised and asked, "What is this book?" The demon answered, "It is your own sayings." So the Baal Shem learned that one of his disciples were keeping a journal of his teachings. He summoned all of them. "Which of you is keeping a diary of my sayings?" The diary was brought. The man who had innocently begun the journal had thought he was performing an act of reverence for his master. When the Baal Shem had the book read to him, he said simply, "There's nothing here that's mine." As I read this vignette, I was reminded of those moments when someone spoke to me words which made a deep impression and changed the direction of my life. Once or twice, I tried to repeat these teachings to someone else, but even if I did, I found them commonplace, almost banal. Their meaning was in the moment. Their meaning was in my need. There was nothing unusual about this wisdom. What was new was that my need for these wonderful words. Hasidism makes much use of storytelling because through storytelling, men can recreate the situation in which the appropriate word is spoken at the appropriate moment. We can quickly sketch in the players, suggest the mood, melancholy, joy, fear, trembling. Imagining the story, we can recreate the moment in which a master or a guru spoke, and we can indicate the impact that his words had. Now, there are in life two kinds of wisdom. One is analytic. It seeks to reduce everything to simple, explicit equations. This is the kind of reasoning that deals with science. The other wisdom is more flexible. It deals in paradox, in the degrees of uncertainty, in depth. And this is the wisdom which deals with the relationships of man to man. In human affairs, there are no fixed laws, only moments. Each person being unique requires a particular understanding of a particular moment. Martin Buber, the first Western thinker to popularize the study of Hasidism among Westerners, described Hasidism as a way of meeting rather than a way of meaning. He meant that retelling the legends of the master, rather than trying to lay bare the reasoning, his reasoning, suggests the way to truth. Hasidism tried to explain how man could relate in love, in friendship, deeply to another human being, or to God. Hasidim, stories are healing. How does a story heal? It heals when we can see ourselves in it, when we can appreciate the wisdom of a mother speaking to her child, of a teacher speaking to a pupil, and relate this to an immediate need in our own lives. Today we think of stories largely as entertainment, as a way to pass an idle moment, to occupy our minds when we want to clear them of the tensions of the day. Yet stories can give us strength and insight. Strange, really, the power that exists in a story. At Hasidim Tov, the Baal Shem Tov, whenever his people were being persecuted, we would go to a particular place in the forest where we would light a light in a particular manner and recite a particular formula of prayer. Then the evil which threatened the people would be averted. In the next generation, the leader of Hasidism, the dove bearer of Mazarich, whenever his people were threatened by persecution, would go to a particular place in the forest and there light a fire in a particular way. But Dov Meir had forgotten the formula of prayer. Yet somehow the power of his person was still there, and the danger was averted. The third generation, a man named Moshe Lieb, was the leader of Hasidism. When danger threatened his people, he would go to the particular place in the forest and say, God, I no longer know how to light the fire, and I no longer know the words of prayer. Yet again, somehow the danger was averted. Finally, in the fourth generation, the last, Israel Rezin was the community's leader. He no longer knew the place in the forest, or how to light the fire, or the formula of prayer. He would sit at home and close his eyes and concentrate on his needs. Dear God, he would say, I no longer know the formula, nor the magical way of lighting the fire, nor do I know the place in the forest. All I can do is to tell the story of my fathers, the great masters. And that story had enough power to save the people. Now, there are some who are fortunate enough to live in contact with a Baal Shem or a Buddha, but most are not so fortunate. We feel ourselves, there are such people in such moments. We tell ourselves there are such people in such moments. We recognize that there is more to man than most men let through. By participating in the story, in the truth of the original moment, we expose ourselves to powers within us which give us a new confidence in ourselves. But there is still more to the story. On a kind of pedestrian plateau where we are moved by what we see and guide ourselves by the results of conventional wisdom, on the level of common sense, we don't allow ourselves to consider the possibility that life might be pure chance and have no meaning. We don't allow ourselves to consider that all of our plans and hopes may be doomed to failure because we assumed a reasonableness of life, which is not in fact there. We like to think of ourselves as rational and reasonable beings, but that's not all there is to life. There are depths and there are heights. There are the depths of passion and the heights of exaltation. Freud taught us, did he not, that most of what we labor reason is in fact not reason at all, but rationalization, self-justification. That most of the basic commitments we make are the result of passion, not of philosophic analysis. That we make decisions not with our minds, but with our emotions. The Greek philosophers bequeathed to the West a legacy which insists
that the mind
controls life.
For them,
the greatest man was the philosopher, one who dispassionately judged what he saw, made sense of it, and govern his life so that it made sense. Presumably, the life of the truly wise man had no irrationality to it. Another group of men, the prophets of Judah, and some later figures like Israel, Baal Shem Tov, insisted that life is too profound and full of energy to be comprehended by any logical postulate. Such men argued that all that man can do is to respond to the word of God, to live with his inner life,
with his inner being.
Open yourself up.
Feel.
Care. Love.
Don't
analyze, because analysis is deceiving. A cold, calculating way
is a destructive way. Israel,
Baal Shem Tov and his followers,
the Hasidim,
tried to do in terms of their almost
medieval world
what many of our writers, painters, and musicians are trying to do in ours. To teach us not to put too much trust in logic. Serious artists have tried to take light and break it up for us
so that we can see
not the surface of things, but the unexpected
blending of color
and shape and meaning.
The musicians have
taken the familiar scale, where the harmonies
are neat and full,
and broken them open
for us.
They've insisted on disharmonies
and dissonance,
juxtapositions of
sound.
Our writers have taken language
and broken it apart,
so as if to say,
if a man
writes something which seems reasonable, beware. Life is fundamentally unreasonable. Look at the hidden,
the uncertain,
at yourself. You have moments of calm. You have moments
of self-discipline,
and moments of fear
and of trembling.
You have moments when anger wells up. You know sometimes that you should not love someone,
but you do love them.
None of us is master of his
emotions.
None of us is truly master of
himself. In their studies,
the Baal Shem and his followers try to
break life open.
They often use a symbol
of the klipa,
or shell. Everything they said is
encased.
Definition: the spirit of man is
encased in his
flesh. Breaking it open,
and what do you find?
Love,
capacity,
sensitivity.
We don't
normally use these. Why don't these
qualities normally express
themselves?
Fear.
One reason, certainty another.
The need to
survive in the jungle
of
have led men to encase himself, man to encase himself so that he will not be
hurt
too often or think
too deeply.
The Hasidim often
spoke of the
error of labeling. Look at a forest. What do you see? The ordinary man
sees trees,
but the open-eyed man sees
specific
trees. If he looks carefully at any
tree,
he can see that it possesses the power to grow. It has the ability to purify the air.
It
suggests to the creator's wisdom and the miracle of life itself. When we break open the
labels
and the fears which encase us from the world, our life is brighter, gayer,
full of
possibility and meaning.
One way to do that
is to tell stories. Stories which often
shock people.
About them. Hasidic stories are
filled after all with
demons, sorcerers,
wizards,
possessions, and the Dibuk. We label their stories
superstitious.
And they are.
We're superstitious folk.
For these stories are not stupid
or
idle. They are designed to suggest
that what appears
on the surface is not the sum of
reality.
That below the surface and above the surface,
in
man's fears and in fears and in man's hopes, in God and in the
satanic within us,
there's also a reality
which we must somehow
come to grips with.
Let me tell you a
Hasidic story. Arya was a
precocious lad.
He was the most brilliant young scholar
in his province.
His fame preceded him
wherever he went.
People flocked to see this young genius. But Arya knew that there were levels of learning he had not
yet mastered.
Not what it was in the books.
The language of
nature, the secret language
which communicates
through silence.
Arya knew only
the Baal Shem Tov could teach him the secret language. Confident the Baal Shem would welcome him
because of his
well-known precocity,
Arya traveled to a little
town where the Baal Shem lived. The Baal Shem that day was teaching his disciples. He entered the room, expecting to be greeted warmly, not a head turned towards him. He had heard the Baal Shem could see without seeing, and he told himself, "He must be here. Surely he will mention my presence." No mention was made. The lessons ended, the disciples left the Baal Shem's chamber, and Arya was left alone, desperately hurt. He would have fled had he not been so determined to learn all that the Baal Shem could teach. So he waited. He heard preparations being made to take the Baal Shem to the village. Arya trembled. "Leave me behind." The Baal Shem came down the stairs. Others
brought down his luggage.
But as the carriage was about to set off, one of the servants motioned to Arya to jump up. So they traveled
until they came
at dusk to an inn.
The Baal Shem went to his room.
No one paid any attention to Arya, and he went to sleep that night in the straw of the stable. During the night, he woke
and saw a light in
the windows of the Baal Shem's room. Arya
crept up the stairs.
The door was open, and he saw
the master
surrounded by a halo of light. Arya was
so overwhelmed
that he fell down in a dead faint. He thought that he heard the Baal Shem say,
"My son,
I know you have come." When morning came, and they set out
again,
they traveled through a forest, and as they were traveling, the Baal Shem motioned Arya to the seat beside him. "My son," he said, "I know
why you are here.
You want to learn the secret of languages. Draw close to me. I'll whisper
this knowledge in your ear,
for you are worthy of receiving it." Then the Baal Shem spoke to him of the
mysteries
of life and the secret language of
the animals and of nature.
As he spoke,
Arya listened to
the secret lore, and through his other ear, he began to hear the
animals' voice.
He could understand what they were saying. Arya was captivated. With one ear, he listened
to
wisdom. With the other, he listened
to nature.
Suddenly, the Baal Shem stopped talking. The minute he stopped,
Arya
could no longer understand the songs of the birds
or the brain
of the animals. He heard only sounds. Arya looked up.
Aghast.
And the Baal Shem said to him,
"My son,
you are a greedy human being. God reveals his glory only to those
who can truly
concentrate on one thing." Now, on one level,
it's
simply a wonder tale about the miraculous
power
of the Baal Shem. On another level,
it can be trivial.
Lessons we so often try to impress on our children. Concentrate on what you're doing.
Put the radio
and the television and the telephone on.
It will
work.
On another level,
you have the basic philosophy of the whole
Hasidic movement.
If you concentrate long enough
on the relationship with God
or another human being,
you'll find
depths within depths.
To live
extensively as most people live, moving from
experience to
experience, from stimulus to stimulus,
from speech
to speech, from conversation
to conversation,
from book to book,
painting
to painting, your life can never be have depth. You will never explore
any
levels of living. Concentrate on one thing.
That is
everything. And concentrate on prayer.
Wasn't it
meant so much to them, but the spirit
went with me
to prayer. As they prayed, they sensed that the world opened up
the
synagogues to God. Something was clearly happening to them.
Let's
translate this mysticism into our own lives. When we talk with another human being without looking him
in the eye,
with one ear attuned to some other conversation, with part of our mind worrying about whether something is boiling in the kitchen,
and we're
going to receive the call
we're so
eagerly waiting for. The conversation
is
superficial. We cannot be
changed by such a meeting.
We leave as we have come.
None the
better for it. We say
about
that it's not how much time we spend
with him,
but the
quality of the time
we spend together. If we concentrate
on
patience and listen,
they will learn
from us and we from them.
If we're
distracted, no matter how much time we spend
with him,
the time has no meaning. We might as
well not offer.
There are levels of concentration. The Hasidic emphasis
is a single moment
on the single meeting,
on a single night with God. How they would have liked it.
So cut up, so apocalyptic. Where are you running, you martyrs?
What do you think?
Wisdom? Are you going to read every book published? Listen to every piece
of music?
See every painting? Do you see that you have
the chance to see?
Do you see what you have the chance to see?
Does your eye
move so quickly that it's simply, a blur? You hear so much that it's all simply sound? Do you move so quickly that no moment has a deep and profound meaning for you? As a rabbi, our worship fails to concentrate on the moment of worship. Hasidim prayed for 3 hours, so they might be prepared. They had freed their minds of the routines, of the commonplace. We lack their uncomplicated lives. But wouldn't we all be the wiser?
Wouldn't we all be the better?
If those relationships which are significant and intensity to them, if we gave time to them that we do not now give, explored with them the depth which are possible in all and every man.